obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, my name's Chris. And I am a very grateful member of Al-Anon. I heard a speaker a long time ago, say that if I'm thankful for something, I'm glad it happened. But if I'm grateful for something, If I'm grateful for something, I want to give something back. And I want to thank the committee, all of you, for taking a gamble. I'm an unknown quantity, I know that. So I got a call about 10 days ago asking me if I would be on standby in case Shirley couldn't make, in case Shirley couldn't make it. And here I am, and very glad to be here. I came with a good friend of mine, Muriel. We met in World Service in Al-Anon, and we've been friends for about 20 years. I see a couple of very familiar faces in here, and I'm so glad for that, because this is not a place that I necessarily get to very often. In fact, in 1997, I was here, and I got a sweatshirt to prove it, which I'll wear this evening, because a good friend of mine in program, well, actually, she's now a good friend. At that time, I think I'd known her for about 6 months, was going to be the luncheon speaker here, and she asked me to come with her to the, and I remember, at that time, you were at the fairgrounds, and I remember what a wonderful intimate atmosphere this is, and it's very different from the great big ones, and I had sort of forgotten about that touch, and I love it. It is just really, really great. I'm so glad to be here, and I owe my sponsor Corinne a thank you, because she's the one who threw me under the bus, which was my feeling the first couple seconds, but I got over it real quickly. I want to thank Cindy and Cindy, who've been my, Cindy's over there. Sorry, Cindy, who have been my contacts for the last few days, and all their efforts to reassure me that they didn't know yet, but they, you know, might know soon. And I was reassuring them that it didn't matter to me, because I'm single, I live alone, my kids are all in their 40s, so my life is my own. So. Anyway, I'm glad to be here. I belong here. I grew up in alcoholism. I was born into alcoholism. I don't have a horrible childhood story. I really don't. My father was the alcoholic, and my mother, for a long time, was the, I could call her an Al-Anon, because she was an untreated Al-Anon, and then she was a treated Al-Anon. She came to Al-Anon in, I think it was 1957, and after hearing Elisa speak this morning, I so regret, and I feel this way every time I hear an Al-Anon speaker, I so regret that when the first Al-Anon meeting started in Cleveland, Ohio, in late 1957, my mother invited me to go, and I wouldn't go, because I said, nope, he's got nothing to do with me. He's got a drinking problem. You're his wife. Nothing to do with me. And also, I was a very, very, very quiet, reserved, shy kid. And, you know, of course, since it was the first Al-Anon meeting, my mother didn't have any experience, nor did anyone else, of what a great experience it was. So would have saved me a lot of struggle for the first 45 years of my life if I had just done that. But, you know, sometimes us Al-Anons have to do things the hard way and learn from our own experience. You know, it would be so much better if I could listen and learn from your experience, but I seem to need to listen, I mean, not to listen, and learn from my own experience. Anyway, I was born into alcoholism, My father was a warm and loving person with a great sense of humor. I don't have a horrible childhood memories. I have vignettes that stand out very clearly in my mind. I remember my father being loaded into what we called at that time a paddy wagon, and I don't know how many people here are familiar with that term or what one looked like. I was going to compare it to a milk delivery truck and with benches inside and flashing lights on the outside, and then I thought, there's going to be a lot of people in that room who won't know what a milk delivery truck looks like either, so why bother? But I do remember I was about, subsequently my mother has told me that I was only about 3 years old when this happened. What my memory of it is this, this vehicle with flashing red lights on it coming up the driveway, and these men in dark blue uniforms or black uniforms, I don't know, obviously policemen, were taking my dad out of the house and down the steps into this paddy wagon. The particular event that had preceded that was my father, in his drunken rage, ripping the railings off the back porch of my grandmother and aunts. Single aunts lived downstairs, and my mom and I lived upstairs. Mom and Dad and I. So you know, my memory as a little person is he tore apart this great, big, huge thing, and just, you know, whatever. And I was grabbing my aunts and begging them not to let the police take my daddy. So that's really what I remember. But about 10 years ago, when I was back in Cleveland visiting my mother, I went by the house, that house, which I had gone by quite a few times. But this time it was empty, and I had the opportunity to walk around it. And I looked at that back porch, and if that thing was 6 feet long, that would be, you know, amazing. It was, and the railing was about here, you know. So, but when you're little, you know, you perceive things differently. The other thing I really remember is that my dad wasn't around a lot. Now, I didn't get told the truth about that, which who knows whether that was a good or a bad thing, but I wasn't told the truth about that. And I just knew that when my dad came home, we had so much fun. He could do the best Donald Duck imitation, there's the word. He could do the best one that I've ever heard anybody do, even Donald. But and my mom and dad were Disney fans up the yin-yang. My father was a radio announcer, which at the time, he was a little fish in a big fish in a little pond, and his escapades often made front page news in the local papers, which of course delighted my mother. Anyway, one of the things I was told was that my dad was away on a business trip in Chicago, and that he would be coming home for Christmas maybe. And that was the year that the song "I'll Be Home for Christmas If Only in My Dreams" came out. And I was just really looking forward to my dad coming home for Christmas. Actually, you know, I don't know that anybody told me that now that I think about it. I was just hoping that he would come home for Christmas. And a Christmas card arrived from my dad that somebody, as it turns out, in the county workhouse had made in a workshop there, and it said on the outside, "I'll be home for Christmas." And I was so excited when Mom opened the card and read it to me, and it said, "If only in my dreams," on the inside of that card. I have hated that song for many, many years. you know, and it's very much around at Christmas time. I've gotten over it. I don't hate it anymore. I can hear that it's actually a very nice song, but you can imagine that I held on to that for a long time, unfortunately. When I was 11, my mother divorced my father because he was often coming over to our house, taking things, pawning them, and using the money to drink. So the only way my mother at that time, it's probably very different now, but at that time, the only way my mother had any protection was to be divorced from him, because otherwise he had as much right to do that as she had to walk in the house. So my mom divorced him. Now I'm from a very strict Catholic background. That's where we were at in the night, and I was raised in the 1950s in Cleveland, Ohio, not the most forward place on the planet, although it is where a lot of the early AA was, and it is where I think it was the first alcohol treatment ward. It might not have been. It might have been the second to Akron. I'm not sure. But my mother got permission from the bishop to divorce my father. My mother never stopped loving and caring for my father. All that evidence, to some extent, by the fact that about 4 months after she divorced my father, she found out she was pregnant, and they got remarried. So when I was 12 years old, I got my sibling, who they called Prince Michael, and my mother sent me a note from the hospital saying, "Your brother Prince Michael will be coming home, and you can be Cinderella. And thank you for being Cinderella and scrubbing the hearth while Dad was alone." Well, I know my mother meant to be funny. I know she did, because my mom and Dad had great senses of humor, but it wasn't. It wasn't, I think, particularly funny to me, and I felt like it turned out to be true. Now, my brother and I were raised in the same family and in two different families. My experience was that I was raised in alcoholism. Then, when I was 11, my dad got sober in AA. He was very active in AA for around 10 years, and then he lost his sobriety and he died of his disease. My brother was born into sobriety and then watched my father go into alcoholism, and he hadn't, well, you know, alcoholism is alcoholism. Of course he grew up in alcoholism too, just treated. The alcoholism of a sober member of AA, which is still alcoholism, but very different. So even though we're both from the same family, we both have very different life experiences. Neither one of us thought very much of 12-step programs. I saw my mother and father both participate, and at that time, Al-Anon was much more of kind of, in Cleveland anyway, kind of an auxiliary women's group connected to AA, and they did the things like most of the cooking at the clam bakes and bringing the cookies to the meetings and things like that. My dad was very active, as I say, and he, as a radio announcer, you can imagine that he was a very good speaker. And I have a lot of sensitivity around people who see well-known public figures at AA meetings and share that with other people. Because I know that my father always wondered and said out loud, "I wonder if they want me because I have a good program or because I'm Howie Lund, the radio personality." So I really feel strongly about protecting somebody's anonymity, even if it's among fellow program members, to say, "Oh, I saw so-and-so at an AA meeting in Malibu." It's like, don't do that. You don't know whose sobriety you could be affecting by doing that. Anyway, my dad, I went to Catholic all-girls school, and I had the very good fortune that because my father worked with AA, I'm sorry, I'm standing too close to this, aren't I? That because my father worked with AA and did a lot of visiting to Rosary Hall, which was the alcoholic ward at St. Vincent Hospital in Cleveland, he got to know Sister Ignatia, who was very active in early AA, and that order of nuns, that group of nuns that were, you know, the nuns who were in charge of that ward at the hospital. And they had a high school in Cleveland, and that's the high school that I went to. This order of nuns was an American-based order, so they didn't bring all their old baggage from 400 centuries in Germany with them, as my elementary school teachers did. And they, you know, they just had a lighter touch. They had a much lighter touch. And they taught me to have a lighter touch. And I'm so grateful for that. And when I graduated from high school, wanting to be, I was such a goody two-shoes. Anyway, I never got my knuckles wrapped. I never got, you know, stood in the corner with my face to the wall for an hour. I don't have any of those stories. I watched them happen, but they never happened to me. That's elementary school I'm talking about, not my high school experience. But it never happened to me because I was, honest to gosh, a goody two-shoes. I really, really was. One of the things I very much regret about my childhood and adolescence, I said that Dirty Dancing was the saddest movie I ever saw. And people ask why, and I said, they say it's the summer of 1963. That's the summer I graduated from high school and joined the convent. All that was going on, and I joined the convent, you know. Sad, sad movie. It's all perspective. Or perception, just like the disease of Al-Anonism. It's a disease of perception. But, I did join the convent. I went in for a year. I wanted to be the best Catholic that I could possibly be. Again, I had the very, very good fortune to pick an order of sisters who were also an American order, but they were a brand new American order. I think they'd been around for about 30 years when I went to join them. And they didn't even let you start off as a postulant, which most other things did. And that was, you know, you had to do two, if you were fresh out of high school, you had to do 2 years of what they called candidacy before you could become formally accepted as a postulant, which precedes getting any kind of a veil or any of that kind of stuff. So I did that, and in that year, the same year that some very liberal changes were happening within the church, and this group of women embraced all those changes, and I got to see, and they stressed with us because they wanted to make sure we made an informed decision. They stressed with us how it was not necessary to have a dedicated religious life to be a good person and be an effective person in the world. And I am eternally grateful that that's what happened. These women opened me up. I had already been opened up somewhat by the Sisters of Charity, but this group just opened me up so much to so many different ways of looking at things, thinking about things. They opened me up so much that I left after a year, but not with any bitterness, just with a different perspective of what I wanted to do in life. So I've been very fortunate. You know, the thing that you'd think would be the most narrowing experience of my life actually turned out to be the most opening experience of my life. Okay, so after high school, I started going to college. Went to the convent for a year, did a little bit of college there, left there, went home to live at home. Now, what had happened in the meantime, in my last year of high school and the year that I was away, is that my father had started drinking again. He lost his sobriety on a trip to Hawaii that his radio station sponsored, and he was the leader of the trip. So I came back and was living with the insanity of alcoholism again. And I never saw him drunk. I just knew he came home late at night drunk. That's not the truth. I don't think you throw a TV through a picture window sober, frankly. So I did see that happen. I did experience one time, and this isn't in fact, this was before he started drinking again. He was mad at me, and I went and locked myself in the bathroom thinking that I was, you know, safe, and he ripped the entire door off the frame. I mean, the whole frame came off. So obviously, even though he was such a nice guy in many ways, and he really was, obviously he had a lot of anger inside himself. But the person who expressed the most anger in our home was my mother. The person that you didn't know what way she was going to be was my mother. She could be really, really sweet one wet day and just a raging, angry person. And not even in, she could do both in a day. And so could I when I had kids. Anyway, I was delighted to meet a guy, and when I went to college, I was one of the first co-eds at an all men's college in Cleveland. And wasn't that a shame? I think there were 15, about 15 of us on campus. It was a Jesuit men's college. And from a Catholic all-girls school to a convent to that situation. Anyway, there I met a guy who had just been, who had from the age of 13 on been studying to be a priest. He'd just been booted out because his ideas were too liberal. I ran into him, and within a year we were married. And I really have, the only regret I have about that marriage really is that I left it. We had three children. I have twin sons who are now 45, and I have a daughter who is 42, sorry, Joy. Anyway, we decided to move to California because we heard on the Phil Donahue show, which started in Ohio and was Dayton, Ohio, as a matter of fact, and was the thing to be watching, and he had great guests, and we saw Arthur Janoff, who founded something called Primal Scream Therapy. And some of you have heard of it, some of you haven't, but the idea of Primal Scream Therapy was that in our infancy, the neurosis is when it happens, and that it gets laid down in us then, but we're too, as babies, we're too vulnerable, so we can't experience it. So what we need to do is go into a padded room and get in touch with those feelings. And one of the weirdest things about it is, for me, was to actually hear myself crying in the tone of a newborn baby. And where does that come from? It came from deep inside. I don't really disagree with the source, but what the problem with Primal Scream Therapy was, they didn't have any solutions. And I saw a few people, I didn't literally see them, but a few people that I was in that group with actually committed suicide, because you were dropped down into all that pain with nothing to do with it, no tools given to you. And I know that the reason my husband and I survived that is because we had three little kids at home, and we each had to go in separately and spend 5 or 6 weeks in isolation in a motel, but the other partner stayed with the kids. They almost didn't let us into primal scream therapy because we had the children, and they didn't think we'd be able to focus enough on the therapy. I think those kids saved our lives because they kept us focused on today. You know, we had a link to today, three links to today, three preschool links to today. So I'm very grateful that that was the case. But in Primal Scream Therapy, their emphasis was, if you're not happy in it, don't do it. I was just about to turn 30, and my ex-husband bought me my first issue of Ms. Magazine, if you can believe that, my first subscription to Ms. Magazine, a decision I think he's regretted for years. And I just decided that if I wasn't happy every minute of every day, that I was in the wrong marriage. And so I chose to leave the marriage. What I believe, I ran into that marriage with delight and seeking a safe place, because Joe was very, very reliable. His family was very, very stable and reliable. And I grew up in a certain amount of chaos, actually, where you didn't know from time to time what would be happening. And after about 9 years, I got bored. I just got bored. And I remember waking up on my 30th birthday and thinking, I'm 30 years old today. I don't have to do anything I don't want to do ever again. Well, you all know how inaccurate that statement is, but that's what I thought. And I had an affair. I was going back to school to become a nurse, and I had an affair with one of my professors. And I told my husband that I wanted to, I hid it from him. He never suspected anything. But after about 3 months of this, I couldn't live with myself anymore. I felt like, if I'm so much out of this marriage that I'm doing this, then I don't want to stay in this marriage, thus giving a slightly noble cast to a very unnoble way of handling things. But I did tell him. We did split up. It was totally my idea. He would have loved to put it back together. I said no. This is a consequence, a direct consequence, of growing up in alcoholism. I'm not saying it's the fault of, I made the decisions myself. But I didn't know really how to survive in stability. I found stability to be boring. So I left. I wasn't getting the signs of love that I expected. Nobody was yelling, nobody was throwing things except me. I was yelling. I was throwing things. I smashed. I swear, by the time I moved out of that house, if you'd have taken a good-sized closet, it could have been filled top to bottom with the things that I smashed in the pieces I smashed them into. So, you know, I was a rager, no question about it. I was a rager. I don't tell you that proudly. I tell you that to be honest. I was a rager at my children when they were very, very little, from the time they were babies. When I was 12 years old, I was given a lot of responsibility for that baby brother of mine, that fairly, you know, the newborn baby brother. I took care of him a lot of times. My parents were not aware of anything that I did to him, but I was physically abusive of him when he was little because, darn it, no matter what I did, that kid would cry. I was in no way ready to have the level of responsibility that I had with my brother. And, you know, and I was an angry person who wasn't showing anything on the outside. And I didn't know I was an angry person. That's one of the insights I got in this program. So I showed that same behavior with my own children. And my ex-husband never confronted me about it. I don't know whether he knew or didn't know, but it is a part of my story that I regret it a lot. But I know that goes on that often the person who not like, I'm not going to put a big percentage on it, but in an alcoholic marriage, it can be not the alcoholic, but the other person who turns out to be the rager, who turns out to take it out on the rest of the family. And that certainly was my case. Anyway, I divorced Joe. We had already moved to California to do Primal Scream therapy. So I was out here in what most Ohioans view of as the land of fruits and nuts and sin. So I wanted out of the marriage, and I left the marriage. I think, if I had had program at that time, I know that I would not have left that marriage. I know that because I would have had a strong support group who I could, share my feelings with, but I didn't have that. My mother was a longtime member of Al-Anon, and she gently, several times expressed her belief that I would benefit from Al-Anon. I just couldn't see it. To me, Al-Anon was only the wives of alcoholics, and I never married one, so what did it have to do with me? Well, that was true in 19... Well, I don't know. That's mostly who was in Al-Anon in 1957. But anyway, I was just determined that alcoholism had nothing to do with me. I didn't marry an alcoholic. I dated them. I hired them. I fired them. And sometimes there was an overlap. Some of the people I hired, I later fired. And and I raised a couple of them. So, there's alcoholism in my life, and my father's family especially, I don't have an aunt or uncle on my father's side of the family who does not have a problem drinking. Is 5 minutes? Okay. Anyway, so I was surrounded by alcoholism. When I finally graduated with my nursing degree, I started working as a nurse. I very quickly got promoted to a management level, which is a slippery slope for an Al-Anon to actually have the title manager. But the good part of that is that there were lots of different seminars you could go to make you a better supervisor. And one of them was called Supervisor as Enabler. And I went to that workshop, and during the course of that workshop, we were required to attend 6 12-step meetings. So I attended Adult Children of Alcoholics, I attended CODA, I attended 2 AA meetings and 2 Al-Anon meetings, and all I was open to hear was how that had nothing to do with me, although I thought some of the ideas from that would be really helpful at work, which turned out to be the case. It wasn't until about 6 years later when somebody that I had befriended on a ski trip...
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
I found out, she told me that she was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to many get-togethers at her house where everybody was AA, everybody except me, and I certainly didn't like the jargon, but I got to see the program in action through my friend Joyce. And one time she said to me, "I am so tired of hearing you complain," she used a different word, "about the same thing over and over. Why don't you just pray about it?" Oh my God, I got so mad at her. I mean, I thought she knew me. Oh, by this time I had walked out of the church, by the way. I left, and I left in anger. She said, "Pray about it." I'm like, "I thought you were my friend. Don't you know anything about me? I don't pray." And I was so mad at her that I showed her, and I did not talk to her for about 6 months. And when I met a guy on a backpacking trip who was sober quite a few years in AA. He suggested that I ought to try Al-Anon, and I did. I didn't tell her for about 2 or 3 months that's what I was doing. But I had the good fortune to walk into Al-Anon, and God gave me an attitude of openness. And I really am grateful for that. Because believe me, if your dad has almost 10 years of sobriety in AA, it's very easy to think that AA or 12-step programs don't work. So when I walked in and saw the Serenity Prayer on the wall, I was like, oh, God, we had that all over our house. But I was open, and God gave me that gift of being open and listening, and I started hearing what the similarities were with me and the people who were there, and focusing less on the differences. And I know that that was a gift from God, because that was not how I lived my life. I was always making myself different from you so that I could blame you. I mean, my gosh. My first meeting, there was a commitment night, a change of commitment nights. And another gift that God gave me that night was the insight for the fact that I needed to take a commitment, because I might not come back for me, but for sure I would come back for you if I had promised to do something. So I took a commitment that very first night, something I think was setting up chairs, something like that. And that was the thing that pulled me back every week. And I am so grateful for that, because I've had the same home group in Al-Anon for 22 and a half years now. And I'm my sponsor's from that group, and it's a very, very active group. We work the steps, we have sponsors, it's just very active. And when my mother would come out to visit from Ohio, she loved to come to meetings of my group with me, because this is so different from how we do it in Ohio, and she loved it. My mother eventually stopped going to Al-Anon. She was about 33 years or something in Al-Anon, and she stopped going because she said, all I want to do when I'm sitting there and some very young woman gets up there, or young person gets up there and talks about being in a relationship with an alcoholic, I just want to stand up and scream, get out while you can. So I think my mother had not completely resolved her angry feelings about alcoholism, to tell you the truth. But Al-Anon has done so much for me, because I've learned so much in program. I came in without a God, because the only God I knew was punishing and structured and whatever. I didn't want to hear the word God when I got here. But I could identify with a higher power in nature. And that's what I did for the first couple of years. I had a job where I drove into work at the sunrise and into the sunrise, and drove home from work many, many days into the sunset. And I could just say, thank you for the sunrise, thank you for the sunset. And when I was up backpacking in the Sierras, I could say, thank you for these beautiful flowers, thank you for this or that. So, and then within a couple of years, I could deal with higher power, and then I could deal with God, and it was fine. I learned to pray here. I learned to pray on my knees. I was resistant to that, believe me, but I learned to do it. I didn't like the slogans when I came into Al-Anon. I thought they were way too simple. I was such an intellectual snob. I thought they were way too simple, and the only thing I was willing to accept as a slogan was the entire Serenity Prayer, because at least that was complex enough, you know, those stupid slogans. And I, you know, certainly don't feel that today. I mean, how many times have I said to myself, okay, Chris, how important is it? Well, okay, Chris, first things first, what's first here? So, you know, I've just grown a lot in program. I have a daughter. I have three kids. In college, and it turns out with my daughter, I should have been concerned in high school, but in college, I was all of them, every one of the three of them. At some point in time, they're drinking or... they never got into heavy drugs, but their drinking and their drug use bothered me. So, but I was very focused on one of them. One of my sons are twins, and I was very focused on David's drinking. Oh, I forgot this was being taped. Anyway, I was very focused on the drinking of one of my sons and convinced that he really, really had a drinking problem. And I completely, you know, wasn't paying too much attention to the other two, as far as that goes, you know, as far as that goes. And his twin brother one day said, "I've stopped drinking because I don't like the person I am when I drink." And I called my sponsor and I said, "The wrong kid quit drinking." I was being tongue-in-cheek, but that, you know, sort of how I felt. And about 3 years ago, as I was driving to the Southern Cal Convention, I was a passenger. I got a call from my daughter, and she said, she said, "With the help of one of my friends up here that I really admire, I've decided to go into AA." And I went, whoa, frankly, that had never occurred to me. And I was going up there and staying there for several days because she lives up in Berkeley. And I was going up there and staying for several days helping with the grandchildren. And she was, you know, she only drank one glass of wine a night. Yeah, right. She told me later that she just kept going into the kitchen and refilling it. I never, you know, how many years in Al-Anon at that point? Almost 20. Never, well, not that much, but it just never occurred to me. And you know what? We were close, but we had a contentious relationship once she started having kids. You know, when I made amends to my kids, I told them I did things when you were little that I really regret. If you ever are faced with those things, like in therapy or something like that, and you want me to step in and help you to work it out, be there, I'll do that. Be careful what you ask for. I have had the opportunity with my daughter to be in a situation like that, and it was really, really good. And it was painful. It was very uncomfortable, but it was really a good experience. I wish my sons would. I hope that someday my sons will also at least take an advantage of a time to express what it is for them, because I have one of my sons is very, very angry. And he's very, very angry at me, evidently. He just went through a rough divorce, and his wife left him in the same way I left my husband. And Dave, you know, he's angry at me because it reminds him of what I did. And I still see him. He's still very, you know, loving and caring and all of that. But boy, that fury, and a couple of times after a couple of drinks, he has gotten right in my face about it, and it's been scary. A couple of those times were very scary. But really, my biggest concern with that is not for his, I mean, excuse me, it's not for my safety or anything. It's really for his well-being. I have a brother. My brother, I can call him an alcoholic because he identifies himself as an alcoholic, but he's an alcoholic who thinks that 12-step programs do not work. Main piece of evidence being my father. Therefore, he doesn't want sobriety. About 3 years ago, when my mother died, she left the house to the two of us, and we did it so that my brother had, I had half of it, and my brother had half of it, but my brother lived in it, because it was back in Ohio, and we had there was an agreement that he had to pay me, buy me out in X number of years, or when my mother died, whichever one came first. He asked me when mom passed away, and I said, I don't need that right now. Pay me later. Save it for when I retire. And he lost the house. He called me when he was in danger of losing the house, and what I knew was that, oh, go ahead, there goes my share of the house. Fortunately, he saw an attorney for a consult who called me. And even when the attorney called me, I thought, oh, God, they're trying to make me responsible for that house. And he told me that I was a second mortgage holder, and that actually I had the first right to any money that came out of any bank sale of the house. So I wasn't, you know, it wasn't out half of that money. However, I had already, when my brother contacted me and told him what was going on, and he was living in a house in Cleveland, Ohio, where the electricity, the gas, the water had been all turned off. It was wintertime. He was horribly depressed. I've suffered from depression. Ooh, the thing my sponsor said I absolutely had to tell you. Anyway, the point is that, no, that not this. The point is that, the point for me is that even as long as I was in Al-Anon, I gave him, not in increments, over time, almost half of what I was going to get from my, so he felt entitled to it. He got it. So, you know, just me. I got suckered right back in because I was always told to take care of my baby brother. And that's what I did until I saw what I was doing. And it was very hard for me to let go of him. He's currently homeless in Cleveland. He's in a shelter. He's been living there for about a year and a half in a very structured environment. I'm glad for that. We don't communicate that much, but we're not enemies. We aren't. He's just, I know, very ashamed of his situation. The one thing that Corinne said I must tell you, and I'll make it brief. A couple of years ago, no, 5 or 6 years ago, I slipped into a horrible, horrible depression. I have a history of depressions, but I have never experienced something like that depression. It lasted for about 3 years. It was horrible. Both my mother and father have been treated for depression. This is familial for sure. But during that time, I got to a point where I couldn't function. I couldn't eat. And I wish that were still the case. But I lost almost 40 pounds and put them back on as soon as I could eat. But anyway, the point is I was crippled by the depression. And during that time, a lot of my friends in Al-Anon, my buddies from program, carried me. They would pick me up. I couldn't drive. I couldn't get it together to drive. They would pick me up and bring me to meetings. I would sit in some of those meetings thinking, what the heck am I doing here? This has nothing to do with me. You know, but I was there. By golly, I was there. They made sure my butt was in a chair. And they made sure I was eating. They nagged me about that. They did a lot of things. They were my, they really, I can't say lifted me up because that would not have been possible, but they kept me alive. They kept me alive. I did have one suicide attempt. If you want to get your kids really concerned and interested in your life to the point where it seems intrusive, get yourself admitted to a psych unit. Amazing how they come out of, well, they were always involved in my life, but if I hear one more time, when are you going to move to an not assisted living, to a retirement community, I'm going to have to shoot them. Anyway, you know, I also went to therapy. I also saw a psychiatrist. I also take pretty powerful antidepressant medications, but by golly, I do not think that I would have done well or been able to do those other three things without the support of the Al-Anon program and my close friends that I would not have met any other way. So I'm very grateful for Al-Anon. I'm grateful to be here today and have the opportunity to be of service. Thanks for listening.
Okay, let's give our speakers, Alyssa and Chris, one more round of applause.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.